Howdy. You're listening to Wild West Filmmaking, exploring the outlaw way of indie film. Raw stories and real lessons from the frontier. Hosted by yours truly, Josh David Jordan.
I did not realize your first film was Urban Cowboy.
Is that correct? First, yeah.
You did theater before that?
Oh yeah, I did theater for. I was making a decent living, you know. I wasn't getting rich or anything, but I was making a decent living doing theater for about 15 years in out of New York. And
You were in New York?
Oh yeah.
Were you involved in any of the acting studios there in New York, or was it? What was your initial training?
I guess it was in, I went to Texas Tech, and the department there, it was part of the speech department, and it was very small. I mean, not many people were that interested in theater, you know, so I got to play all the good parts. And if you went to the University of Texas, you didn't get to play the good parts till you were in graduate school. But I got to play all the good parts when I was a freshman, so it started. And I'd go to school when I liked the plays. I'd look and see what the plays were that semester. If I didn't like the plays, I'd go work on an oil rig and make some money so I could go. My dad was putting me through college, but he wanted me to study law. I said, I don't want to study law. I don't, because if I'm a lawyer, if I'm going to be a lawyer, I'm going to be doing all your research work, because he was a lawyer, and you're going to be in court having all the fun, and I don't want to do that. Neither did my brother, neither did my sister, so we, none of us.
Nobody
wanted to do that. And finally, he got disgusted with it and retired because lawyers started putting their names in the yellow pages. He didn't believe in advertising. He said that's not dignified. So he wouldn't advertise. Now you got them on billboards all over the place.
Social media.
That's really disgusting. Yeah.
Was there a play that was like, that was the play that got everything going? You're like, I can do this. I want to do this.
When I was 7 years old, I was going to the Western movies in La Mesa, Texas, at the Majestic Theater. I'd go every Saturday. And I liked people like Wild Bill Elliott and Alan Rocky Lane, those guys, you know. I didn't like singing cowboys that much. Mm-hmm. I didn't mind them, but I didn't like them all that much. I liked Rex Allen pretty well. But I really liked the sidekicks, you know, the comedy guys like Dub Taylor and Fuzzy Jones and Gabby Hayes and Walter Brennan and those guys. Because they got to have more fun, they didn't have to take a bath. And they'd get in a fist fight, but they'd always get beat up. They'd get knocked out immediately, so they didn't have to fight. Mm-hmm. The heroes always had to fight the whole fight and they never lose their hats.
Yeah.
So I didn't care anything about being that. I wanted to have fun.
Are these silent films? Are these?
No, these were.
Yeah.
Movies made in the late 30s, 40s.
These on the back lots in California?
Yeah.
On all those ranches?
Yeah.
You watch enough of them, you see that same pecan tree.
Oh, yeah, the same stuff. All of it's in Vasquez Rocks or up in Simi Valley or somewhere. And so it was, that was where I decided, well, I could do this.
At seven?
Yeah.
Yeah.
About seven. And then I never grew up. I never grew out of it.
Were you chasing? Is that something you chase and always put yourself in a position to be as close as you could?
Yeah. Yeah. You know, when we played cowboys and Indians, it was serious to me.
Yeah.
If they shot me and I was dead, I'd stay dead. we quit playing, you know. I'd lay there. But no, if I was in a fist fight, I wasn't grinning and doing the stuff. Mm-hmm. I was always playing it.
So you leave Texas Tech, and you go to New York. Like, you just pack the bag.
No, I was in Tech for one full year, and then I didn't like the plays they were doing, so I left to go work on an oil rig, and so I wasn't a student right then, so I got the draft notice. This was in the early 60s, so I got my draft notice, and so I looked around, and I knew if I was drafted, they'd put me in the Army, and I'd be in for 3 or 4 years, and I knew I could join the Marine Corps for 2 years.
And are you in New York at this time?
No, I'd gone to California.
Okay.
I was in basic training in California, then I went to Camp Pendleton, and then I spent about 6 months in Thousand Oaks, and then went back to Pendleton.
And you did 2 years? Served 2 years?
A little under
2 years.
Yeah.
And are you at that time, what are you, going to the movies a lot? Are you, what was the next step to?
Well, I went to Los Angeles a lot because I was in Camp Pendleton. I didn't go to San Diego because all the sailors were down there. And sailors wanted to fight Marines.
Okay.
And Marines all had that white wall side,
yeah, you know,
haircut, and then you could see a Marine.
Yeah.
And I didn't want to fight anybody. I'd kind of tried to talk my way out of a fight. The only way you can get me to fight is to hit me hard.
Right.
And so I just avoided those places.
Mm-hmm.
But I was going up to L.A., and I'd go to the library and read about Vietnam, see what the deal was there. So I pretty much knew what was going on.
Right. So let's fast forward to, there's probably a really big gap because you didn't do your
first. I went back to Tech.
Okay.
After I got out.
Okay.
And did the first production in their new theater there.
Mm.
When I started there, the whole theater was about the size of this little apartment.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they had about 50 seats,
yeah,
out there. And if you had to make an exit on stage right, you had to go outside,
yeah,
and go around the place and climb in the window on the other side.
It's like the Okra House Theater, man.
Yeah.
Posey's Theater.
So they had a big, nice theater they built. So I was in the first production there. And I applied to the Colorado Shakespeare Festival.
Okay.
And I got a job there playing, four plays in repertory. But it was more like a scholarship, you know.
Right.
Most of the actors were either professors or graduate students from college. And they let me, and I had to audition for it, but they let me in. And I played some pretty good parts there, but I also worked on a ranch.
Mm-hmm.
In the daytime, once we opened the plays, I worked on a ranch in the morning and afternoon so I could make enough money to live. Because they gave me a little money, but they also wanted me to live in a dorm, and I was put in the dorm with a roommate who was a guy who enjoyed the company of other men.
Mm-hmm.
And that I didn't feel like I fit in that situation too well, so I went to work on a ranch outside town with another actor. We shared a house.
Okay.
Out there.
And so you're doing theater, you're working on ranches. until you get Urban Cowboy?
Then after that, I went to New York.
Went to New York.
And the following year.
Okay. And you're doing theater there.
Yeah.
So at what point did you have to get representation, an agent? Because I feel like in that time frame, like you span such great times in filmmaking from like, I feel like, and it's probably nostalgia, but like the 80s, all of the 80s just seemed like there was lots of money. There was lots of productions. You have VHS, you know, you got blockbusters. Yeah. If a film didn't do well in the theater, it's going to make all of its money on the VHS. Yeah. And so.
Yeah. And there was three television stations, basically.
Right.
I mean, the cable things all showed old movies and stuff. They didn't show anything, any new product. So you had limited, you had a huge market for a limited product.
Mm-hmm.
Now you've got a huge market, but you've got golf channels, and you got this channel, and that they got a channel for anger management, which was a series that I did with Charlie Sheen.
Yeah.
The whole station is anger management.
Oh, are you serious?
Yeah. And now they've got that. And I don't get anything out of that because we gave up residuals and cable back in the 80s.
Okay, yeah, that was going to be a question.
I was on the board of directors at SAG in the 80s, and they said, oh, no, that's a cable just a...
It's like streaming today.
Yeah, they said it's not a market that's going to do anything. And I said, we don't know what it's going to do. You know, you're giving up something. And they say, we've got to give it up so we can keep our insurance.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we kept our insurance, but as soon as we did that, then we started having to pay for our insurance.
Mm.
And now our insurance isn't worth a damn.
Mm.
And
there's no more DVDs, there's no more VHS. It's
and now what they've done with the insurance, they've got it so as when you turn 65, you've got to go on Medicare. They drop you from the insurance unless you make enough money to get to qualify for the insurance.
Right.
And then you have to pay for it. So it's, you know.
But back in the early 80s, it's...
Yeah, it's free.
Great insurance. And people are trying to get their cards.
Yeah.
Everybody's working and trying to get those however many lines. I forget how many lines it is before you can get your card. So do you have an agent in New York? Do you have an agent in L.A.? How do you
I didn't. In New York, at that time, an agent was not necessary, really.
Interesting.
You could go to the Equity office, which was up on 45th Street, and... go up and look at the bulletin board, and they'd have, not only would they have parts, they'd have open calls for casting, but they'd also have jobs that you could take to, you know, make a little money on the side.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I did. Also, you could go in there once a year and get a little voucher so you can go buy and go get a new pair of shoes for free at a shoe store.
Okay.
because a rich guy was in Equity, and he'd walk around all over town, wear his shoes out.
Right. Put a hole in his shoes. That's some big dogs right there. Wish everybody could see that.
Yeah.
And so are you in New York when you get your first feature film? Are you,
no.
You're in Los Angeles?
No, we had a blackout in 77.
Okay.
And the blackout lasted a week. I mean, we were just in the dark for a week. and my wife at the time say, let's go to the movies where there's air conditioning. I said, there's not an air conditioning. We're living in caveman days.
Yeah.
This is not, there's not any such thing as air conditioning. There's not any restaurants open. There's not anything.
Mm-hmm.
And about the third day, I said, I'm done living in this hellhole. Let's get out of here. So we sublet our apartment to a guy who immediately introduced himself to the landlord, which we had a rent-controlled apartment, $90 a month in Greenwich Village, one block from Washington Square.
Yeah.
And so he immediately threw us out and threw him out.
Yeah.
Threw all my paintings out, all kind of stuff, you know, everything. But we moved to California, got in there. Our Ford Pinto station wagon, loaded it up, took off, looked like the Joes leaving Oklahoma in 1930, and went to California. And I was there for nearly 2 years. We got there in 77, mm-hmm. in the summer of 77. And it was just about 2 years before I got Urban Cowboy. I was getting some other stuff. I was mm-hmm. getting some commercials and a few other things. But I kept having to go back and do work in California. I'm in New York.
Mm-hmm.
Went back and did an off-Broadway play and did a couple of Lart theaters and some dinner theater stuff,
mm-hmm.
things like that.
So when you're doing Urban Cowboy, are you thinking, because it was like, you know, there was lots of, because the soundtrack's so amazing, there's, you know,
yeah.
Charlie Daniels. And,
yeah, Irving Azoff put together that soundtrack.
And it's beautifully shot, and it does feel like Texas. And did you think at that time, like, this? Did everybody think this is going to be a big hit, or is it just no one knew, or is it just a job, or did people feel like this could do something? Because I know that Stetson had closed all of its factories, and there's only one left. It was in Garland,
yeah.
the one I still go to this day. I have friends that work there. And because of Urban Cowboy, they had to, like, farm out stuff in Mexico because Cowboy hats were the biggest thing in the world because of Urban Cowboy.
Yeah, and had these stockbrokers in New York walking around with elephant hide boots.
It was a phenomenon.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so after that,
well, I knew we had
something
good, because John was such a phenomenon at that time.
Mm.
At that time, we didn't know. I mean, I knew about the project. I'd heard about it from other people. As a matter of fact, a friend of mine who had been, his first play was was down in Alabama, a play that I wrote called Sucker Rod Smith and the Cisco Kid. And he was playing a part in this, an Urban Cowboy. What they originally planned to do was to make it a low-budget movie and do it starring the kids that the magazine article was about. The guy playing, the guy that Bud was based on was such a disagreeable little bastard that you couldn't get along with him.
Mm-hmm.
And the girl was just impossible, you know. Mm. So,
with Deborah Winger's character?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So they decided, well, we'll hire John Travolta because he just opened Saturday Night Fever.
Yep.
And he was on all the rage at that time. And I thought, well, I don't know how that's going to work out. You know, I didn't have any idea.
Yeah.
And I had to go in and meet him when they wanted to cast me in the part. And he came in and said, boy, we're going to have a lot of fun with this. And I said, yeah, I bet you are. Nobody told me anything. And then my agent called and said they want you to do it. And they told me how much I was getting paid. I said, I didn't know. I said, is that good? She said, no, not really, but it's good for the first one.
Yeah.
And I said, okay, fine. And I went, and when I got to Houston to do rehearsals, I went in and they handed me a handful of money, an envelope full of money. And back in those days, your per diem was not counted as anything. You know, you didn't pay taxes on it or anything. Mm-hmm. They just hand you an envelope with money in it. Well, I thought that's what my pay was. I didn't know. So I lived on that the whole time I was doing the movie. And I had them just send my pay to my bank.
Mm-hmm.
And I got back home. I got back to California and bought a house. I didn't know whether that was going to be the last thing or what.
Yeah.
But as soon as I got back, I got the part of the sheriff on Dallas, who took my jurisdiction was the ranch, mm-hmm. where the ranch was. It wasn't in Dallas.
Yeah.
And so when people called me up and said who shot JR, I said, that's out of my jurisdiction. I don't know. But anyway, I arrested all the Ewings except for Miss Ellie. And she never left the patio, so I didn't, you know, she couldn't arrest her for anything, but I arrested everybody else.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think I arrested Charlene Tilton. I think she used to... too clean to arrest, but all the rest of them I did arrest. And so it was that was a nice thing. And then I got, right about that time, I also got stir crazy.
Yeah.
With Richard Pryor and Gene Wilder, which was a big splash.
Oh, yeah, I know that movie.
And then Any Which Way You Can, Clint Eastwood movie gorilla.
Orangutan, yeah.
Orangutan. And so they all opened at the same time.
Whoa.
And that's, you know, the parts were enough different so that it was, you know, people thought, well, he can do different things. And then they were casting the Thornbirds.
Mm-hmm.
Which was a miniseries based in Australia. So I went in to meet with them, and they said, well, can you play an Australian? I said, I don't see why not. An Australian ain't nothing but an English Texan, so I guess I can play it. So that I got in that one, so I was doing a different accent. Yeah. So.
I don't think I've seen that. That's not Tom Selleck. No, that was
the
film with Tom Selleck.
Richard Chamberlain.
And I think I did see that you were on an episode of Columbo.
Yeah.
Did you work with Peter Falk?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, man, I found him really interesting.
I had one line when I said, I offered him a cigar, and he starts to bite the end off of it. And I said, no, don't do that. Do it like a gentleman. Use a cutter. Mm-hmm. And he didn't like for anybody to ad-lib, because Rod Steiger had a part in there, and he said he couldn't cut it together because all Steiger had one sentence, he'd make a page out of it, you know.
Oh, yeah. He'd steal the scene?
Yeah. And so he didn't like for anybody to ad-lib. So we're in rehearsal, and he takes it and starts. I said, no, don't gnaw it like a beaver. Here, use a cutter. And he said, gnaw it like a beaver, yeah. You know, that's funny. Use that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, so green light. Yeah, yeah.
He let me do anything I wanted to.
That's a pretty good
that.
Peter Falk, by the way.
Yeah.
Excuse me, miss. Growing up, that was like a show. My dad liked to watch it, and it was kind of over my head a little bit at the time. But now it's like, you know, Wings of Desire is one of my favorite films. But now it's like, you know, Wings of Desire is one of my favorite films. And Peter Falk is just a treasure.
No, Peter Falk, he was nominated for an Academy Award, his first movie.
Oh.
Yeah, Pocket Full of Miracles.
Yeah, Pocket Full of Miracles. Yeah. Him and Cassavetes. I mean, that's really how I know him the most, is just him with John Cassavetes. Okay, so after all this, War Games is around the corner, right?
War Games, I went in to audition. It wasn't an audition. I just went in to meet with John Badham and the casting director. And just three of us were in there. And they told the casting director, said, I offered Barry a part in my last movie and he told me to go to hell. What do you think about this one? He said, I want you to play this general.
Yeah.
But not like any other general. I mean, this guy wears his uniform like a mechanic wears his overalls. You were a jet pilot in Korea, an ace. You got through that. You worked your way up through the ranks until you're a four-star general and you're the head of NORAD. And use any country expressions you can think of. He said, don't worry about the script at all. You think you can do that? I said, I believe I can. He said, okay, we'll make a deal. And so
that was the audition.
That was it.
That was it. It was a conversation. Gosh, I mean, that movie is such a, you know, I guess it was I forget my exact age, but that was like a big film just in my, you know, adolescence, growing up.
I think that is 80, maybe 83.
I think so.
82 or 83.
Because the cool thing about those movies is, you know, VHS had caught on and then, you know, you could just go for 10 years and go to the Blockbuster and go and just wear out War Games.
Yeah.
You know, or whatever film it is.
Now they don't send screeners anymore from the Academy.
Right. Yes.
They stream them. And I don't know how to do that.
And hell, they have passwords.
I don't know how to do that. I don't even want to do that.
Yeah. I remember Matthew Posey, when we would do plays at the Okra House Theater, he would have this little basket and was all the films that none of us had seen yet. And so, you know, you'd watch it, of course, it'd say property of the Academies and whatnot. So you've, like, the cool thing about your career, Barry, is, like, you've done, like, the whole gamut of, like, theatrical, like we said, VHS, the hotbed of DVD, and then, you know, things start to, so let's think about No Country for Old Men. Was that 2007? What year was No Country for Old Men?
About that, I guess.
2010? I forget the exact.
I don't remember. It's been a while.
So is that something you've already done? Lonesome Dove is another, and we could sit here and talk.
Lonesome Dove was before Northern Exposure.
Right. And that was
in Lonesome Dove, I think, was in the late 80s.
Correct. And that was a phenomenon.
Yeah.
Lonesome Dove.
That was a big
that was the coolest thing ever. Yeah. I still have a VHS that I've kept of a Lonesome Dove. So you're working with Robert Duvall.
Yeah.
Did y'all work any more after that together, or was that just Lonesome Dove?
No, I haven't worked with him again. We're friends, you know. I presented him. Brought Boxleitner and I presented him with his Hall of Great Western Performers Award for the Oklahoma City deal.
Oh, cool.
And Sam Elliott and Catherine Ross came and presented mine to me.
Oh, wow. Yeah, I mean, that's one of those things. I really don't think, from my recollection, like, that may have been, like, the last of the great era of, like, having that many good actors and that type of story.
Well, you're doing miniseries now. It's cost, the cost is too much.
Right, for sure.
And they can't afford to pay us anymore. I make half what I made before.
Right.
You know, I don't, not even that, you know.
So when you're doing Lonesome Dove, do they have you for a certain amount of days? Are you like, because they don't know what's going to happen next, they just need you handy?
No, I came in, I think it was 3 weeks at the beginning of the shoot. They hadn't cast Tommy Lee yet as Captain Call.
Right.
I came in, Chris Cooper and I came in, did the stuff in Fort Smith. Did that on Willie Nelson's ranch.
Mm.
He's got a little western town
there. Mm-hmm.
And we did that. And Helena Human played Peach, woman,
mm-hmm.
a scary woman. And she was very good. She kind of was overdoing it a little bit. And I said, you don't have to do anything. Just come on with that chicken. Just walk up.
Yeah.
Hold it down below the head. I'll do the rest of it. So, but anyway, it was we did that and then took it up to the point where Janie throws rocks at the bad guys. Now that one of the bad guys was the guy that plays the priest, the loony priest in your show.
Oh yeah, Matthew Posey?
Yeah.
Oh yeah. Matthew Posey was?
Yeah. Yeah. He played.
So you and Matthew Posey have been in three projects together. You've been in Lonesome Dove.
Uh-huh.
No Country for Old Men.
Uh-huh.
He plays the sporting good salesman with the tent.
Yeah.
And then y'all were just in El Tonto Por Cristo.
Yeah.
And it spans like
80s.
Early on.
Well, he'd gained so much weight. I thought he was the heavy guy on the horses.
Oh, yeah.
Because he's about that weight now.
Yeah. And so everybody knew how to ride horses, like Tommy Lee, obviously, like Duval.
Bobby, Sam Shepard, Bobby is
Sam Elliott.
A fox hunter.
Okay.
Tommy Lee, of course, has a ranch. He had a little kind of a week or two boot camp.
Okay.
Brought all the cowboys in so they all knew how to ride pretty, sort of.
Right.
You know, I had to forget how to ride.
You had?
Yeah, I had to forget how to ride. I had to
kind of
munch my reins up and I couldn't even do it. But everybody else was, you know, good. Danny had that. Danny Glover went in. He did pretty good.
I love some Danny Glover.
Yeah. And
is there a camaraderie on, I don't know what it was like, but having all these great actors, right?
Most of them I didn't have any contact with.
Mm-hmm.
I went in to makeup one day. There was somebody sitting over in the chair getting something done. I don't know what. I believe actually Tommy Lee getting his beard bleached.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't pay any attention. I just walked in. I was getting my makeup on. He said, "Welcome home, Barry." "Hey, Tommy, how you doing?" That's when I found out he was playing Captain Call.
Mm-hmm.
But he was very good. He's an awful good actor.
Yeah.
He's just awful hard to get along with.
He has a relaxed intensity on screen. I heard he has a lot of intensity on the sidelines.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
For Tommy. So did y'all hang out when y'all, was there hangout times when you were doing something like that? No.
Not in a deal like that. We're just, I came in. Most of the people weren't even there when I did my first part.
Gotcha.
Then I came in, I did that, And I was off for, I did two movies between the time they dropped me and the time they picked me up. I did two movies in between.
Oh, wow.
And then came back and finished it up. So I did 3 weeks to start with, I think. And then 2 weeks at the end when we were in New Mexico.
Oh, wow. What's your favorite? Is, you think, feature film, miniseries, on a series? Because like we talked about Northern Exposure, which is like, whenever I'm talking with people, I'm like, oh, you know, Barry Corbin's in my new film. They're like, oh, Northern Exposure. I mean, most people,
yeah, a lot of
talk
lot
about
of people,
Northern Exposure.
That's their
favorite. Did you enjoy that?
I did at first, when we first started. And then they changed producers. Well, they had a lawsuit. And I didn't know. We were on location, so none of us knew anything about the lawsuit. But somebody had written a pilot and mailed it to himself in an envelope. And when they did the summer replacement series, he didn't do anything about it. But when they picked it up and it was a big splash, then he sued Universal and CBS. I think Universal.
Mm.
But it also had to do with the writers and had to do, it's messy.
Yeah.
And so they brought in a producer who didn't like the show. And
that's not good.
So he started rewriting it to his taste. And so if you remember, about the third season, everything started getting weird.
Weird, it did, yeah.
And I started going to battle with him. And I finally got to the point that I'd fly down to L.A. and just show up at the production office, and then nobody'd be there except the secretaries. I mean, there wouldn't be anybody there.
Right. Where were y'all filming at?
We were filming at Washington.
Okay.
And finally, I was the only guy who was nominated for an Emmy the last season. And this producer, David Chase, later did The Sopranos.
I was going to say, the same to David Chase, yeah.
My manager said, boy, you know how to pick your enemies. I said, well, he wouldn't have hired me for that anyway. But anyway, we all got an award for the best cast in SAG, the SAG Awards.
We got
the best
ensemble,
cast,
yeah, yeah.
Best ensemble.
Yeah, yeah.
And David put out an announcement, a directive to everybody. Said no actors will be allowed to accept the award.
On stage.
Yeah.
Right.
Only the producers.
Only the producers. This is coming from him.
Yeah. So I went into the producer that was running the show up in Washington. And I said, take a directive to David Chase. I said, dear David Chase, if you try to talk to me or speak to me in any way at the SAG Awards, I'll whip your ass either on the floor in there or out in the parking lot, and I don't care which. And he said, you don't want to send that? And I said, yeah, send it to him. And they did. And he came walking over to me at the SAG Award, had his little 9-year-old daughter, and he put
her between us. Oh, yeah, I bet.
And said, hi, Barry.
Yeah.
I said, hello, David. How are you doing, sweetheart?
Yeah.
It's nice to see you. I didn't tell her dad was an asshole.
Well, that's then, Hollywood.
Then David said, when they got me for an Emmy, he said, you can't go. I said, why not? He said, because you'll be working. I said, oh, that's going to look good in the tabloids, isn't it? He said, what does that mean? I said, well, it means I've got a publicist, too. And he said, oh, well, you can go, but we don't have any budget to send you down there for an airline or hotel or anything. I said, no, that's all right. He said, so I called up Jimmy Medeiros, who supplied the horses for Lonesome Dove, and I said, Jimmy, you got a couple of horses. I'm one of them completely bomb-proof, and the other one can be, you know, just kind of used to crowds. He said, yeah, I got a couple of them that kind of match him, pretty flashy. I said, okay. I also need a permit to ride horses on the street in Pasadena on Sunday night, whatever date was. He said, what are you going to do? I said, my daughter and I are going to ride horseback into the Emmys. He said, you're what? I said, yeah, you heard me. I said, how much is that going to cost me? And he said, not a damn thing. I want to see you do it. And so he brought horses over for us. But by this time, they'd caved in and got us a hotel.
No.
And a limousine, so we put the Wranglers in the limousine, and we rode the horses up. My horse was a little nervous, so he left the deposit on the red carpet.
Yeah.
And the Wranglers got out and ran off with the horses.
That's good publicity right there.
Then we went up to the, oh, they killed it. I mean, Universal just, it was on all the news the first night, and then gone.
You couldn't find it anywhere. They buried it.
Yeah. And the Army Archard was the guy, you know, he'd always greet people. He said, well, you picked an interesting way to come into the Emmys. Is there a story behind that? I said, well, apparently Universal and CBS and the producers weren't making enough money selling coffee cups and sweatshirts and whatnot to be able to get us a limousine, so we took the cheapest transport we could find. And boom.
Yeah. They had all the money in the world. Yeah.
I still haven't worked for Universal since then.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I don't care.
Yeah, so things have, like, changed so much. Do you feel like the reason you've had such a great career and some of the roles you've done are nostalgic with films for me. Is that like the help of an agent, or is that just gut, you knowing what's right? Now, I know, like, you know, we don't get to pick and choose everything and we don't get cast in everything, but I just feel like your roles always come at this right time, you know, like we talked about, you have, you know, is it Netflix did The Ranch, correct?
Yeah.
I mean, that's a whole new concept. It's the Netflix is, you know, was a pioneer, and it's like you always, whatever wave, you're like a surfer, whatever wave is coming through, I always feel like, well, there's Barry on that wave, you know? And like with No Country for Old Men, for example, I think it was Josh Brolin who was talking about it. And he said, when he and Javier said, when they were making it, like, I don't know if this movie's going to be any good. Like, they didn't know what they were really doing. Did you feel like that when you were working with the Coen brothers? Or did you feel in your gut, like, because that scene with Hugh and Tommy is, I mean, it's one of the most nostalgic scenes in cinematic history, I think.
What I knew they were making that movie because my son, Chris, had auditioned for the part of the sheriff or the deputy that he kills at first. And so he told me he'd audition for it, and he said, there's got to be a part for you. And then I said, well, if they know me, they can call me if they need me.
Mm-hmm.
He said, well, you ought to find them. You ought to just send something to remind them.
Yeah, nudge them a little bit.
No, no, they'll find me if they need me.
Okay.
So, like, I guess it was a month before they were starting to shoot, they called my manager in L.A. because I was already living here by then. Mm-hmm. I called my manager and said that the Coen brothers wanted me to do this part in the movie. Apparently, they'd seen all these old men. I mean, people that weren't even actors, you know, people that were singers and things, mm-hmm. you know, just anybody, all these old guys. And they never called me for it. I'd met them before for other stuff, but mm-hmm. they'd called and they just offered it to me. And I said, well, send me the script. He said, it's just one scene, but it's a good one. I said, okay, well, send me the script. They sent it to me. Now, I always read the script from the first, so I know where my part fits mm-hmm. in. And I started reading it. It's bloody, murderous thing.
Yeah.
I thought, well, oh, Cormac. I don't know. And then I got to the part of Ellis, the part that they'd offered me. Mm-hmm. I read that scene, and I went back and read it again. And I didn't even finish the script. I called my manager and said, hell yes, I'll do it. That scene's the movie.
That scene is the movie.
It explains the whole thing.
It does.
And it was, and when I went in, after I got cast, they sent a wardrobe person down to me. In Fort Worth, and fitted me for my clothes. It was just old ragged clothes. And then they called me and wanted me to come to Santa Fe.
Oh, Santa Fe.
Where they were doing pre-production mm-hmm. in Santa Fe. And so I came up to Santa Fe, but I had to go from there to Kansas to do a little short movie.
Oh.
A little one out, about more 30-minute movie, I mm-hmm. guess. And just me and a horse. And, there was a couple of scenes with other people, but mainly it's just me and the horse riding across Kansas.
Mm-hmm.
And so I did that. And then I had to be in Marfa, the last day they were shooting there was on a Saturday.
Mm-hmm.
So I had to work till about 4 o'clock on Friday on this short movie. And then they had to use my stunt double to do a couple of things after that to finish it up. But the Coen brothers hired a plane to fly me into Marfa from Dighton, Kansas, because there wasn't an airport in either place. So they flew me in there, and I got up the next morning, we did it.
Like that?
Yeah, but every time, when I flew into Santa Fe, Tommy Lee and I just went through the scene one time, that's all, you know.
Oh, that's interesting. Wasn't
any notes or anything. We just
Give you notes? Did they give you, or did they let you do, I've heard several different things. Did they let you do that? I know that they don't like improvising is what I've heard, but are they giving you any direction, or you and Tommy are just rolling?
Yeah.
And then maybe tweak a little bit here and there?
They didn't do anything. We just went through it and they said, okay, let's go. That's it. Go to lunch.
Wow. How many takes did you do? Do you remember?
No, it took all day. They brought those cats in
mm-hmm.
and had to do a bunch of stuff.
Right.
Set those things.
They're different angles of the, over the shoulder.
When they'd come to the end of it, they never stopped us. We'd go through the scene every time, all the way through. Never stopped us. And then they'd, you know.
Yeah. Yeah.
let's do it again. And that's it.
Yeah, because that's the line you said, the monologue, when you say, he knew the score, even if Aunt Ellen didn't.
Yeah.
And that's the movie.
Yeah.
Like, that's the score, even if, you know, it's just everything for that, which is a pivotal scene. I mean, that was like, for me, I was like, he should have been nominated for like a best supporting actor, just because that monologue is such a nostalgic thing that will always sit with us for eternity.
Well, it was a hell of a thing. And we broke for lunch, and Tommy said, "What do you think about these guys?" And I said,
"About Joel and Ethan?"
I don't know. I mean, I don't have to think anything about them. I'm just working with them today. You better think about whether you like them or not. And he said, "Well, I don't know. Do you think they were making fun of us and old brother, Where Art Thou?" I said, "What do you mean making fun of us? Making fun of our music?" I said, no, it was an homage to '30s depression movies.
Yeah,
that's what that was. I mean, it's no, not making fun of anybody, and they were, they liked that music. Mm-hmm. That music was terrific.
Yeah,
he said, "I don't know." I said, "I think maybe they were making fun of us." I said, "Well, you better get over that, because you're going to be with these guys for the next couple of months. So you better just calm down."
Yeah, because you think the movie's about Josh Brolin, but really it's about Tommy Lee.
Yeah.
Which is like the most beautiful. And that's the, I'm blanking out on her name, but she was the woman that was in Tender Mercies with Robert Duvall. She played Tommy Lee's.
Oh, yeah. Tess Harper.
Tess Harper.
Yeah.
She's phenomenal. She, the camera, it's like one of those things, like you have it as well. There's certain people who have it where it's like the camera knows something, and there's like some twinkles that happen.
The funny thing about this, that about that movie was Tom.
Robert Duvall?
No. I'm blanking on his name now. Got directed War Games. John Badham.
John Badham?
Yeah, John Badham. He saw that movie, and he directed me in an episode of Psych later on.
Oh.
And he said, "You know, I watched that movie, and I thought, who is that guy? I know that guy."
Yeah.
He said, "I want you," but he said, "but you look like you've just grown up out of the desert dirt."
Yeah.
I mean, I couldn't place it.
Mm-hmm.
He said, "I had to wait for the credits to realize it was you."
Mm.
I said, "Well, I didn't change my voice any." He said, "No, but you changed your inflections. You didn't sound like the same person."
Yeah.
I said, "Well, maybe so, maybe so."
And so you was there, and, you know, a lot of people who were listening to this podcast, they're young filmmakers or people who try to figure things out. You know, it's, I feel like with your, just your whole entire story, your whole life, it's like just the consistency and like waiting for the right time, just showing up. Because I mean, like we said, the ranch on Netflix, you've done One Tree Hill, you've done so many films. I mean, we can sit here, you've done almost 300 films. So, you know, this podcast would be very, very long. And then we fast forward and you do Killers of the Flower Moon, which is one of the biggest films that came out, was nominated for so many things. Is that like, do you feel like in your gut, in your heart or whatever, that if it's right, it's right. If it comes, it'll come. But there still has to be a little bit of get after it too, right? Or do you think just your get after it was early on, and then you just start to build this resume and you're in people's heads? Because I mean, you're probably in everyone's head when they think about cinema, right? Because you've played such incredible roles in such nostalgic films that maybe, like, you know, for me, it was like when I was doing Autanta per Cristo and we had talked, I kind of expanded the role of Terry Don. because I was like, I was writing for you in mind, right? Does that happen? Do people, are people writing stuff?
Oh yeah, in people mind? Tell me that.
Yeah.
Yeah. As a matter of fact, there was one time years ago, I was still living in California, and they were advertised, they had this breakdown, and it says, a Barry Corbin type.
Yeah, I believe it.
And I said to my agent, I said, you know, look at that. Did you put me in for that? And he said, no, it doesn't sound right for you. I said, well, put me in for it. Let's see what it, so they put me in for it. I went in and I read it and they said, now, can you give it a little more? I said, you know what? You better cast somebody else in this because I think what you are wanting me to do is something that I can't do.
Right.
I can't do an imitation of myself. Because Ben Johnson always said that if they ask me for to read for a part, I never get it.
Interesting.
And, well, part of the reason was that he couldn't read. He went through the third grade and he was uncomfortable reading.
Gotcha.
But it's true, you know.
Mm.
That when they think of him, they don't think of him. They right. think of their image of him.
Right.
And there's no way that he can live up to their image of him.
Yeah. It's like they don't want Barry Corbin. They want a Barry Corbin type.
Yeah. So they'll go cast Gaylord Sartain or somebody.
Right. Yeah, I mean, it was so crazy, just the madness that was happening when we were making El Tanto Per Cristo, and, you know, I'm so thankful that you were available during a SAG interim agreement strike.
Yeah.
And I remember I was on the phone with this lady from SAG, and I was like, well, this is a small budget film, and I got Barry Corbin, Matthew Posey, and Jordan, you know, I have some people that are SAG, and, well, we're filming on next Friday. And she goes, well, you can't. You don't have the SAG interim agreement. I said, well, then give it to me. She says, well, we can't. I said, well, you need to because we're filming next Friday.
Yeah.
I said, I'm spending everything on our trucks, our camera. This is such a small film. I got everything. I'm flying people in. So it's in your best interest if you go ahead and give that to me now because we are going to be filming. I don't want anybody to get in trouble. That was at 3 a.m. We got a thing from Los Angeles. It was like 1 a.m. She said, you can make this movie, Josh, but we don't want to hear hide nor hair of you again. And you can't make any more films this year. We're not going to allow it. Because I was bugging them so much.
Yeah.
And, you know, all that fighting, all that stuff. And it was like, I was never casting or writing for a Barry Corbin type. I was for you. And I know that when we had that monologue and you were like, hey, you mind if I was been thinking about it? You mind if I do a little? And it was so great to like you're improvising, even though you had, you know, thought about it, but that the opening to the monologue, you know, I still have it, you know, a lot of things don't make everything in the picture.
Yeah.
But I have that and it's such a beautiful thing. And it's like, it was a very important moment in my life to have, you know, people like you and Matthew Posey and just to like, you know, all get together. And I guess my thing is, no matter if you're 13 years old or if you're 7 years old and you get a little spark of wanting to act, and now at your age, you still bring that. Because I remember that day, it was like 114 degrees. I was like, Barry, you want to sit down? You're like, you sitting down? I said, no. He goes, well, I'm not sitting down. And we just kept working, you know?
Man.
And I wish that day, it was only one day, and I wish we could have done it for 2 weeks. But, you know, maybe in the future. Well, not maybe. I mean, I'm writing a lot of stuff right now. So I think that maybe just was the beginning. As I end this podcast, I want to say that maybe El Tanto Per Cristo was just the beginning of Barry Corbin and Josh Jordan making pictures.
Yeah, good, good. Well, I had a thing kind of like that happened in Yellowstone.
Mm. Yeah. Taylor Sheridan?
Or Taylor, yeah. Taylor said he was we were at some concert somewhere, and he was about half drunk. He said, "You looking for a job?" I said, "Have you got one?" He said, "I can write one." And I said, "Well, have at it." And so he wrote this thing for me in Yellowstone, and he was directing it. The one scene was pretty tightly written,
mm-hmm.
and with Jimmy, the guy that played Jimmy,
mm-hmm.
Jefferson, I think his name is. But the other scene was just a scene between me and Buster Welch, who mm-hmm. was an old cutting horse.
Oh, yeah.
And he told me later, he said, he told me then, he said, "I'm not going to say action. I'm not going to say cut. I'm just going to roll camera.
Yeah.
And I want you to talk to Buster about horses." So that's what we did. We sat and talked about horses for about 45 minutes.
Oh, wow.
And he told me later, he said, "I've got all that footage."
Mm-hmm.
He said, I think I'm going to give it to Texas Tech. And I said, "Well, that's good. Give it to Tech. They'll put it in there."
Yeah. Like archives.
Yeah. In their archive.
Yeah. That's beautiful.
But we sat there and just, we just talked. And, it was a treat because I hadn't seen Buster in a while.
Mm.
And we'd won a buckle together. He was the legend. I was the celebrity. And then there was the youth.
Mm-hmm.
So we all together, we won buckles for that.
Oh, that's cool.
And I put mine up for auction for the Roundup for Autism this year.
Mm.
After Buster died, I said, Buster used to ask me which buckle I was wearing. I was always wearing this one.
Mm.
So we're going to auction this off. It's time for me to pass it on.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody else can have it
for
20 years. So a guy paid $18,000 for it.
Yeah.
And I signed it. But
that's amazing. All right, as we
got a picture over there of us talking in the
park. Oh, right on. There. I'll have to check that out for sure. So we'll wrap it up. And, you know, this is Wild West Filmmaking, which is, there's some young folks out there. There's some folks my age or some folks your age listening to this probably. And, you know, what little nugget of advice after all the great work you've done, what's just one little nugget? I know that's probably almost impossible because you have so many nuggets. What's just one thing you could leave the audience with about?
Well, usually what I tell young people that want to be actors, first thing I ask them is why? Why do you want to do it? If they want to be famous, I said, no, you can be famous for something else. Something's not this hard. I said, in order to be able to do that, to even start to do this, you've got to be prepared for more rejection than you can imagine. Most people, when they come out of school, they go get a job. They work at that job for 5, 10, 15 years. Then they decide it's time to move on, so they move to another job. And all that time, and all the time that you're working, you'll be rejected. Maybe 30 times in a whole career. An actor is rejected that many times a week.
Yeah.
And, it's constant rejection. And you keep saying, well, it's not personal. Well, you're a salesman, and your product is yourself. It can't get any more personal. So That's where you are. You got to be crazy.
You got to be crazy. And you're one of the craziest. Well, Barry, I appreciate it. This has been a blast for me. We could talk for the next 4 hours about everything you've done.
Well, let's go eat.
Let's go eat some Mexican food and just talk.